The economic storm clouds over Europe are creating gloomy forecasts for the U.S. Today, the International Monetary Fund downgraded projected U.S. economic growth by a full percentage point through 2012 because of the European debt crisis. So what will that mean? For a check on that and other financial news that's been sort of off the front burner, we turn to New York Times business columnist Gretchen Morgenson. Her latest book is Reckless Endangerment. It investigates the roots of the financial crisis. Gretchen, welcome as always to Here and Now.
I'm happy to be here today. Thanks so much for having me.
Okay, and let's start in Europe. A lot of that crisis sounds familiar. We'll review some of it. In the early 2000s, countries like Greece had a borrowing boom because of low interest rates. Then they had a bust. Ironically, they hired Goldman Sachs to try to hide how bad their debt was. But then you also write that European banks hold a lot of government debt and weren't required by regulators to have the cash to back it up. And that it's worse than what American banks held in mortgage securities? How bad?
Well, you know, it is so much larger. That was really the point of my article, was to try to help people to understand why the goings-on in Europe are so troubling and potentially could, you know, have an impact on us. These sovereign debt holdings of the major banks in Europe are very, very large, and they have been actually encouraged, as you mentioned at the outset, to hold this debt because they don't have to set aside any capital to do so. So what you see is, instead of the country having banks that are funded by depositors, like our banks are, these banks are in a particularly difficult situation because they're funded by investors who are short-term oriented. And so if they sense a problem in these banks' holdings, they will run away screaming. They will take their money out, and that is really what is happening here. They see these debt holdings. They are, crashing in value, and so the investors are fleeing.
Well, and then there's another problem that directly, umbilically ties the U.S. to Europe. You write this is crucial. Let's take a look at it. Credit default swaps. Now, these are those insurance investment tools that brought down banks in the U.S. You say investors bought them, betting that Greece and other countries would fail.
Actually, what some of this is insurance. It is, purchased sometimes by banks or other investors who hold the debt of these countries. And so some of it is an insurance policy, but a lot of it also is, as you point out, bets on the direction that these countries' debt holdings will go in. And so you do have a position where people are betting against a country, betting that it will default. And so many, many of these insurance policies have been written. I think the number was $32 billion in credit exposure on the countries of Greece, Portugal, Ireland, and Spain as of the most recent figures. And the question really is, who is on the hook for these insurance policies? We saw what happens in AIG, when AIG could not make good on the insurance it had written on mortgage securities, and that is the same situation here. We wonder who's on the other side. Because this market is opaque and unregulated, we just don't know.
Well, hold it right there, because I think we're going to be saying this quite a bit over the next few minutes. How could that be? Because after AIG and this idea of, you know, somebody is going to owe a lot of money on these credit default swaps, but you don't know who, so everybody's waiting to see which company is going to have to pay out all this money, and will they have that money or will they crash? This is exactly what happened. And there was this move to regulate credit default swaps, to make them transparent so you'd know who held them. How, after the crisis, has that not happened?
That has not happened. It is supposedly being written. As you know, these are some of the rules that Dodd-Frank has delegated. That's the legislation from 2010 that was supposed to produce a safer environment for investors. But many of the rules have not yet been written. And these, of course, include credit default swaps trading on an open market where you can see who's on the other side. That is still in the dark. That market is still shrouded in secrecy.
Well, but do we have a sense of how much, how many, millions or billions have been invested in these bets, these credit default swaps?
Well, yes, as I said earlier, $32 billion in credit insurance against Greece, Portugal, Ireland, and Spain. But another number that we don't know is how much has been written on the banks that hold these sovereign debt issues of the troubled countries. That's a number we don't know because they do not separate out the single name banks, such as how much insurance has been written on, you know, a French bank or a German bank or an Italian bank. That is not information that we have access to.
Well, so it would seem obvious, but let's say these countries do default, they collapse, these banks have to pay out. I mean, it would seem obvious. We're a global community now, but how would that affect the U.S.?
Well, one thing that you can say with certainty is that it would, if some of these banks have difficulties overseas, they are going to withdraw from lending. They're going to restrict their lending, very similarly to the way our banks did after the 2008 crisis really erupted. And so, you know, many American companies borrow in foreign markets for their overseas activities, and so that would have an impact on American companies right there. But again, another impact that we just don't know is who has written the insurance on these bets, who has really just sort of made their balance sheet the risk that these bets pose. We just don't know who those institutions are. So that's where we're hoping not to see an impact on our shores, but we just don't know. It could easily happen.
So, oh, great, credit could get even tighter.
Credit could definitely get even tighter. And this is one of the reasons why you saw last week the Federal Reserve and other central banks opening up their coffers really to European banks for dollar loans. And this is because investors have been pulling out, and so these foreign banks do need to repay their investors with dollars. So the central banks have stepped in, but that is really only a temporary help. They really, that can't go on, and it can't go into the, you know, trillions of dollars and stay there for long periods.
New York Times business columnist Gretchen Morgenson. We've been talking about financial issues, some of them on the front burner, some on the back. On the front, well, on the front, the European crisis. And Gretchen was just explaining how the Federal Reserve has been trying to get some people willing to lend money to European banks as investors there are fleeing. But Gretchen, let's pick up there because, as we said, the Fed is meeting today and tomorrow. And some are wondering, is there anything else the Fed can do to encourage lending? Your colleague, Joe Nocera, there at the Times, writes today that he's convinced that nothing that is happening in Washington, President Obama's plan, nothing that's happening can help the bad economy. The biggest problem is the lack of lending, nothing else. And he cites an economist, Paul Kasriel, who says the Fed should just print money out of thin air and buy up all this bad debt that's floating around to get credit flowing. Now, Republicans presidential candidate Rick Perry have said that that would be treasonous. But what's the thought in the market about that, that this is the one big problem, getting money moving?
Well, it is the big problem. And, you know, you did see, unfortunately, in 2008 and 2009, when the taxpayer was giving $750 billion to the banks so that they would start lending again, there was very little lending that went on. So, unfortunately, we have a relatively unsatisfying history here as far as throwing money at banks to try to make them lend. You know, what they're doing instead is hoarding cash and, you know, beefing up their balance sheets because, honestly, they still have many assets on their balance sheet that they are marking at values that are far too high because they can't afford to take the hit to their capital. So here's the situation. Okay, if you throw more money at them, are they truly going to lend? That's really the question. If we were certain that they would, then I would be in that camp as well. But we've seen it before that they just don't lend in response to that kind of a practice.
And you've just said that some of that is to shore up some of these bad assets that they have, mortgages and such, that aren't worth what they are saying they are worth on paper. But why else? I mean, just could you weigh in on that? Because economist Paul Kasriel again says this idea that there's, you know, they're uncertain, that there's uncertainty about the market is a bunch of hooey. So why else is money not flowing? Why aren't they lending, in your opinion?
Well, I do think it's because they feel the need to have a stronger balance sheet because of all the losses that they've encountered, you know, between 2008 and now. But I also think that if we were to have a strategy of making the banks carve out their bad assets, really call a spade on what these assets are worth, you know, and say, look, I know that the second liens that I've written on these mortgages are worthless, and let's put them in a bad bank, good bank, bad bank, split off the bad assets and then write them off over time, that would be fine. I think that's a good approach. But just throwing money at the institutions and then allowing them to continue to pretend and extend in their values on their balance sheet, I think is the wrong approach.
We're talking with Gretchen Morgenson of the New York Times, who's also been taking a look at some other suggestions post the financial crisis and seeing how they're doing. And let's just take a look at one, clawbacks. This was the device that regulators were using to make, or said they were going to use, to make executives pay back part of their salaries or bonuses if it turned out their company had lied about how much money the company was making, had cooked the books. This was passed as part of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act in 2002 after the Enron scandal. So you took a look. How's that going?
Well, you know, I was kind of shocked, to be honest with you, about how few cases have been brought using this new Sarbanes-Oxley rule. And in the cases that have been brought, there have been really small numbers that have been generated. I think the classic example of this is the New Century Financial situation. Now, that was one of the most aggressive lenders out there, mortgage lenders. Mm-hmm. And they collapsed in a heap in April 2007, and there was an enormous bankruptcy examiner report that identified seven different kinds of accounting irregularities at the company. Well, so the SEC does a clawback, and what do they get from their former CEO? They get $542,000. Now, this was a person who made $2.9 million in incentive pay in just 2 years at the company, 2 years that were very, very, you know, boom years in the mortgage arena. So you have to wonder, are they really being as aggressive as they could be?
Well, as you write, it took until 2007 for the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, to bring its first case. And since then, only 31 executives at 20 companies have returned some pay. By the way, just a quick example of another one.
Well, we had a situation where I guess it was Navistar was a company where they had been having difficulties with their books. And that was a situation where the chief executive, who is still there, now he was not charged with wrongdoing. He did return stock worth $1.32 million. But during the period of time that the inappropriate accounting took place, he had received $2.2 million in incentive pay. So, again, he was not involved. He was not charged with wrongdoing. But as the CEO, he was supposed to be aware and signed off on the Sarbanes-Oxley rule. So he did have to pay back.
So, Gretchen, we're going to have to wrap up here. But it's pretty disheartening. I mean, we've taken a look at two things. One, the credit default swaps, the suggestion to make more transparent. They weren't. Another, clawbacks that were supposed to get back, you know, money from executives. They haven't. You say this is all because of lobbyists. Do you see it changing?
I don't see it changing, and you know, this was one of the flaws in the Dodd-Frank law, actually, and that was the extreme delegation to regulators to write the rules that people were going to have to abide by in institutions, and that really gave lobbyists two bites of the apple. They could help manipulate the first time around when the law was written, but also when the regulators make the rules, then they have another opportunity. So I think that's a really interesting and illuminating lesson for the future, that Congress should really legislate. They shouldn't delegate the rules-making process as much as they did in Dodd-Frank.
Gretchen Morgenson, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and business columnist for The New York Times. Her latest book, Reckless Endangerment, about the financial crisis. We always love having you here, Gretchen, but frankly, it's depressing.
I know. I'm sorry about that. Next time, I'll be happier.
Gretchen, thank you.